Welcome to the sixth episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Brandon Scalia. Onc Live On Air is a new podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These are premier and renowned meetings that educate community-based oncologists and healthcare professionals on novel treatment approaches for patients with cancer. The summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. In Onc Live On Air, you can expect to hear from an academic oncologist on the thought-provoking presentations they give at these meetings. The topics vary from systemic therapies, surgery, radiation therapy, to emerging therapeutic approaches in a particular disease. That brings us to today's episode. On August 16th, we traveled to Charlotte, North Carolina for a State of the Science Summit on ovarian cancer. The meeting covered genetic testing, frontline therapies, surgical options, treatment for recurrent disease, immunotherapy, and updates in uterine sarcomas. There have been a number of recent updates in ovarian cancer, with exciting data surrounding PARP inhibitors, immunotherapy, and a greater awareness on genetic testing. Most recently, in June 2018, the FDA approved bevacizumab in combination with carboplatin and paclitaxel, followed by bevacizumab monotherapy, in the frontline setting for the treatment of women with advanced ovarian cancer following initial surgical resection. We sat down with one of the faculty who presented at the meeting, Thomas Herzog, MD, who is the professor of obstetrics and gynecology and deputy director of the University of Cincinnati Cancer Institute. At the meeting, Dr. Herzog discussed how frontline therapy has evolved from IV chemotherapy, intraperitoneal chemotherapy, and dose dense regimens, citing clinical trials such as HIPEC, ICON-8, and GOG-252. He also shed light on the frontline approval of bevacizumab and why it's important for clinicians to think about how to utilize this agent in clinical practice.
So, we really owe all the progress we've made in ovarian cancer to clinical trials. And if we look at over a decade ago, it was those clinical trials that allow us to adopt paclitaxel into the care of women with ovarian cancer, which significantly improves survivals, as we've seen. And then it's also clinical trials, phase three trials, that have really made a difference in terms of us being able to take a very cumbersome inpatient regimen and make it a very convenient outpatient regimen with substituting cisplatin, which had a lot of toxicities, with carboplatin, and then taking the paclitaxel infusion time from 24 hours to 3 hours. So that's been extremely helpful. If we then look at what the clinical trials have done further, is really about trying to improve survival beyond that. And so if you look at where we were over a decade ago, our standard was carboplatin and paclitaxel given every 3 weeks. Then people said, well, what about giving maintenance therapy, giving a taxane after therapy ends for a prolonged period to see if we have improved survivals? Indeed, that was done. GOG-178 showed an improvement in progression-free survival. The endpoints were set up in that trial that if there was a difference in PFS or OS, they stopped the trial. And in that case, then we never had the overall survival data because of the number of crossovers and so forth. So the trial was designed with a novel taxane as well as just regular paclitaxel versus observation in patients who had a complete response after initial treatment for ovarian cancer. That was GOG-212, which did not show an advantage for giving a year's worth of extra taxane, either the novel taxane or the traditional taxane. So that took that off the table. The next thing that we looked at was this concept of dose dense. Can we give more therapy over a shorter period of time, higher dose over a shorter period of time, and improve outcomes? And so the Japanese came out with a trial, JGOG, that in two widely read papers showed an improvement in progression-free survival, and then they had a final analysis on their overall survival that showed a significant improvement. So the thought was that we should be giving dose-dense chemotherapy, and so most people moved to that, and we were sort of all following the lead on that. And then GOG-262 was our attempt by the GOG to somewhat mimic that trial. The problem was that we allowed bevacizumab to be used, and over 80% of the patients chose to be on it. It was given as an option. And so patients were randomized to dose dens versus non-dose dens, but they were able to choose whether they went on to bevacizumab. The overall results of that trial absolutely contradicted the results of the JGOG trial that showed that dose dens was beneficial. However, in the small subgroup, unplanned analysis, it showed that if you did not have bevacizumab, there was an apparent improvement in outcome if you had dose dens therapy. But it's interesting. I've had a run of patients who've had pleural effusions and large volume ascites, and to me it's a no-brainer because it does such a good job getting those patients off of having to be tapped either through a thoracentesis or paracentesis. And so to me that's very, very helpful to have that agent available in that. We also have some subgroup analysis from ICON 7 and so forth that looks at high volume disease and high risk of relapse, and that those patients actually do have an improvement that's even greater than the other group, and perhaps even an overall survival advantage. So those are patients that I strongly consider Bevin as well. Should it be used on all comers? Many do. It's a change in behavior for many of us because of insurance and so forth, now likely being able to pick that up. So I think it's an evolving landscape right now, but you'll probably see more use moving forward.
Following Herzog, we spoke with Wendell Naumann, MD, who was one of the co-chairs of the meeting. In his lecture, Naumann highlighted the surgical options for patients with newly diagnosed ovarian cancer. Although he explained that there aren't novel techniques when it comes to surgery, he emphasized that neoadjuvant therapy is beginning to play a large role, as well as the increased use of minimally invasive surgery.
So obviously surgery is an important part of ovarian cancer treatment. The traditional paradigm has been that we do surgery first, followed by chemotherapy. I think we have emerging evidence that giving chemotherapy first is a reasonable option for these patients. And the morbidity from the surgery is lessened, and we improve the optimal and complete resection rate in at the time of surgery. I think the criticisms of some of these trials is the survival has been less than we would expect, but I think that's because the patients that we choose to do neoadjuvant chemotherapy on are really a subset of patients that do poorly in general. So we've now had four randomized trials that have shown that this is a reasonable approach and at least has an equivalent outcome to primary debulking. So I think that's become more of a choice. And really, in our institution, we're looking at using minimally invasive surgery to accomplish this so we can actually further reduce the morbidity and mortality from the primary surgery.
Genetic testing is gaining more awareness in the field of ovarian cancer. According to one of the meeting speakers, Jubilee Brown, MD, a professor of gynecologic oncology at Levine Cancer Institute. However, while the mainstream media has helped emphasize the significance of testing, she said that more work can still be done. Brown talked us through why it's important for patients to undergo genetic testing, as well as who should be tested and when.
First of all, by detecting women with hereditary mutations, we can identify people who are at risk for developing ovarian cancer and intervene to prevent them from ever getting ovarian cancer. It's actually a 95% reduction in risk if we can identify those people. So testing is really important. And the other, I think, key component is in patients who have ovarian cancer, it's really important to do genetic testing for two reasons. One is that we can identify their family members that might be at risk and prevent them from ever getting ovarian cancer. The third issue really is that among women with ovarian cancer, we have targeted therapies that act specifically on those mutations. And so we now have this entirely new class of drugs called PARP inhibitors that are especially useful for women who have BRCA and other related mutations.
Moving into recurrent disease, we sat down with Robert Coleman, MD, who is a professor at the Department of Gynecologic Oncology and Reproductive Medicine at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Coleman lectured on the updates in this setting during the meeting and highlighted the initial use of chemotherapy before the FDA approvals of PARP inhibitors. Now these PARP inhibitors are beginning to be tested in combination with other agents, such as checkpoint inhibitors, However, bevacizumab and chemotherapy is also an option, as seen in clinical trials such as OCEAN 5, GOG 213, and Ariella. Coleman had this insight to share.
The impact of PARP, I think, on in the recurrent setting has been, it's been pretty profound. I would say that what I've seen is that the maintenance indication, although it's been around for a while, I'm actually a little surprised it's not taking up more. So it makes me think that either people don't believe the data or they're selecting certain patients for which this therapy might be considered most efficacious, which is fine. The treatment indication, I think in a BRCA patient that's identified early on, I think it's high on their list. And because now we are routinely doing germline assessment, and some places are doing somatic assessment for BRCA, this is almost like, okay, if a patient shows and they have that, the question is, have they had a PARP yet? Because we know it has single agent activity, which is rivals chemotherapy, as I mentioned. We've already started doing those trials of looking at chemo versus PARP for the treatment setting. So I think in the treatment setting for known, under the labels, which is somatic and germline BRCA, the drugs are obviously have a big impact. The maintenance indications, I think, probably still need a little more education. So we're grateful for opportunities like this conference to be able to talk about, what the role of these drugs are in that maintenance setting. And as many people know, and we're anxiously awaiting, we'll have data in the frontline maintenance setting very soon for olaparib, and then early next year for niraparib.
That leads us to the potential of immunotherapy in ovarian cancer, which was discussed by Matthew Powell, MD, an associate professor of obstetrics and gynecology in the Division of Gynecologic Oncology at Siteman Cancer Center of the Washington University School of Medicine. A number of checkpoint inhibitors are under investigation in the ovarian cancer space, including nivolumab, ipilimumab, pembrolizumab, atezolizumab, and avelumab. While some clinical trials were disappointing, researchers are actively exploring combination regimens and other methods of bringing immunotherapy into this landscape.
Immunotherapy is an emerging area within gynecologic malignancies. We now have approval for therapy for our MSI-positive cancers, with mostly that being endometrial cancer, but a small cohort of ovarian cancers will be MSI-positive. But there's a lot of interest and enthusiasm for developing this further. The initial phase two studies looking at efficacy in our recurrent ovarian cancer patient population, this has been a little bit disappointing with our response rates kind of in the single digits or teens, really, and prompted a lot of interest in investigating combinations and whether those combinations are combined with chemotherapy, which we know induces neoantigens, and probably we used to think that maybe chemotherapy would damage the immune system and make immunotherapy not work, but it seems to actually be the opposite. And we have some data from lung cancer that looks to be a compelling combination. We're also looking at combinations of anti-VEGF strategies in combination with immunotherapy, PARP inhibitors combined with immunotherapy, and moving therapy not from recurrent resistant disease, but moving it to frontline therapy is really the trend within gynecologic malignancies at this point. So I think it's a very exciting time for us. And we'll be touching on many of these aspects during the talk this evening.
Beyond ovarian cancer, Richard F. Rydell, MD, an associate professor of medicine at Duke Cancer Institute, gave his perspective on the systemic treatment for patients with soft tissue sarcoma for uterine and leiomyosarcoma. While this remains a rare and challenging condition to diagnose, novel agents are needed in this landscape to improve on patient outcomes. Here was what Rydell had to say.
Uterine sarcomas are extremely uncommon. They represent less than 5% of all uterine cancers. And even within that heading, there are a number of different subtypes, including adenosarcoma, endometrial stromal sarcomas, both low and high grade, PCOMAs, undifferentiated uterine sarcomas, and leiomyosarcomas. And so despite the heading of uterine sarcoma, it really represents a number of different histologic subtypes with varied clinical behaviors. The treatment is evolving. Surgery still is the mainstay for localized disease, and radiation therapy will be used for local control. Chemotherapy can be considered, although in my opinion the data is not as robust as we would like. While there has been some encouraging data for using different regimens in different subtypes like gemcitabine and docetaxel in combination or for uterine leiomyosarcomas, a prospective study unfortunately failed to accrue, and as a result it's not clear to me that we'll have a definitive answer as to whether or not adjuvant chemotherapy actually benefits that patient population. There is the emerging role of immunotherapy in sarcomas as a whole. I think what's clear is that across a broad selection of patients that it may not be the home run that it is in other more common cancers like melanoma or lung cancer, but I think it is clear that there are certain subtypes which may benefit. It's not clear that it will benefit patients with uterine sarcomas, but I think that still remains to be seen.
Finally, we sat down with Angela Secord, MD, our second co-chair of the meeting, who gave a comprehensive overview of the various updates occurring in the ovarian cancer space. From genetic testing, to emerging agents in the pipeline, to the trio of PARP inhibitors, to immunotherapy, advances in this paradigm continue to occur. Secord, a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Duke Cancer Institute, weaved all these advances together and shared what this progress means for the future of ovarian cancer treatment.
What we provided today during the first half of the meeting was the overall landscape of how you treat somebody with advanced, newly diagnosed ovarian, tubal, or peritoneal cancer. We covered the chemotherapy options as well as the surgical management. And importantly, we also discussed genetic testing. And what this part of the program did is provided a hint of what's to come, and that's really personalized medicine, personalized care for women who have these types of cancers. I think it's incredibly important to understand that it's not a one-size-fits-all paradigm anymore. Like Dr. Naumann's presentation on surgical management of this disease, surgery is certainly part of the cornerstone of management, but we need to decide who is somebody who we should consider primary debulking surgery versus neoadjuvant chemotherapy followed by interval debulking surgery and more chemotherapy. And what Dr. Brown was able to highlight is the importance of genetic testing in order to identify women who have mutations like BRCA1 or 2 or homologous recombination defects that may benefit from PARP inhibitors, as well as identifying those women who are increased risk for breast and ovarian cancer and other types of cancers that are associated with this disease so that we can prevent cancers. I mean, that is so striking to me. The fact that if we identify women who have a genetic predisposition to ovarian and breast cancer, and now we're understanding that it's even right beyond that with increased risk of pancreatic cancers and other cancers, and we can institute cancer screening for these specific cancers or treatments to try to prevent these cancers or surgery to prevent these cancers from even developing, we'll be able to reduce ovarian, tubal, and peritoneal cancer incidence by about 20%. Let me just give a little bit of history. There was a decade, at least a decade, where nothing much was happening in ovarian cancer. There was maybe one approval of a combination of drugs that we were able to utilize anyway without FDA approval. And then all of a sudden in 2014, things started to change. We had approval for bevacizumab in the recurrent setting, in two different settings of recurrent disease. We had approval of bevacizumab in the recurrent disease setting, specifically for women with platinum resistant disease initially, and followed by that for women with platinum sensitive recurrent disease. And now recently we have approval in the frontline setting. So we're able to have options, right? We can institute bevacizumab with chemotherapy followed by maintenance bev. We're able to institute bevacizumab with another chemotherapy and at various times during their treatment course, during a patient's treatment course. In addition, we have the approval of PARP inhibitors. And not just one PARP inhibitor, but three PARP inhibitors. So I'm hoping that since we have approval for three different drugs, that that will be able to have an effect on pricing. Keep pricing from being driven up too high or lower pricing sooner. We'll see how that all plays out. But the bottom line between all these approvals is that now we have four drugs in ovarian cancer we didn't have before. And then, let's move forward, we have a basket approval for pembrolizumab, which is an immunotherapy. So women whose tumors have microsatellite instability or women whose tumors have deficient mismatch repair, they are candidates for an immunotherapy at this point. And that encompasses not just ovarian cancer, it's really disease type agnostic. So women with endometrial cancer, cervical cancer, so forth, who have these biomarkers.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to our sixth episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit OncLive.com, sign up for our e-newsletters, and check out OncLive.com/State of the Science Summit. You can sign up for our meeting in a city near you. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. That's all for today. Thank you for listening to OncLive On Air.